welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how water shaped our past and how new water challenges are shaping our future. We'll discuss the nearly secret life of water. Then, so-called memory entrepreneurs try to change how we remember the past in efforts to shape the future. Did they lose the Cold War memory fight? Has memory itself become a political battleground? Although it's the most important substance in our lives, we hardly think about water, where it comes from, how it's used, and its precarious future. Water determines the outcome of just about everything, the fate of cities, the production of everything from a pair of jeans, a flat-screen TV, to concrete and food. All that is alive is completely dependent on it. And now, as our water sources and water purity are increasingly threatened by overuse, pollution, climate change, and a growing human population, it is going to reshape how we live. Perhaps it is time to learn about this profoundly important substance, according to our next guest. Award-winning author and journalist Charles Fishman joins us now to discuss his latest book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Welcome, Charles Fishman.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Perhaps we should start with a few water facts. You start with the ways in which we use and need water in your book and the ways that we waste it. Give us some numbers. Give us the scope.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The average American uses 99 gallons of real water a day for things like taking a bath, washing your hands, boiling pasta, making coffee, flushing the toilet. But just at home, the electricity that each of us uses at home is 250 gallons of water a day. So 10 gallons an hour, every hour of every day for each of us, not per family, to keep the computers running and the flat screen TV on and the refrigerator cold. We need more than twice as much water to make the electricity that our homes use as we do for the actual water we use. That's just a tiny example. Everybody's omnipresent cell phones, their laptop computers, their tablet computers, every computer chip in the world requires a kind of water that is so clean, it is literally considered too clean to drink. Drinking it would leach the nutrients right back out of your body. And so again, whoever imagines that their iPhone requires water or a particular kind of sort of exotic water, you know, there's water required for almost everything we do, and most of it is hidden.
Now, compare the United States water usage with the rest of the world. Walk us through that.
Well, the Americans, as with many other things in the world, Americans are large consumers of water. On a per capita basis, in the developed world, we're the largest users of water out there. But per capita water use is a little misleading. For instance, all of the agriculture in the United States, the per capita water use, the per person water use in the country, includes all the farmers and all the power plants. So industrialized nations end up with pretty high per person water use. What's interesting in the United States is that as a country, we use more water in a day than we use oil in a year. And I think that's so startling because you hear so much about the price of oil and so much about the availability of oil. We literally use more water in a single day than we use oil in a whole year as a country. And look how little attention water gets. And I think this is one of the most hopeful things I discovered in reporting this book. The United States actually uses less water today as a country than we did in 1980. We've gotten much more efficient in the big users of water over the last 25, 30 years. So we use less water to produce an economy of $13 trillion than we did to produce an economy of $6 trillion. We've literally doubled the economic output of the country without increasing the amount of water we needed to use at all. And that's pretty impressive.
One of the things you point out is that some 40% of the world doesn't have good access to water. So give us the lay of the land here. Who has it? Who doesn't? And what is this phrase, water wealth and water poverty?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, it is not that much different than other necessities of life in the world. People of means, people with good jobs, people who live in developed world countries have such good access to water that they never think about it. So there are very small pockets of the United States that don't have good water service, and unfortunately those are mostly on the reservations of Native American peoples. But in general, 97% of Americans have such good water service they never think about it. The same is true across the developed world, in Canada, across Europe. The water service is so good it's invisible, and it's also incredibly inexpensive. We never even think about the price of water. In fact, across the U.S., not only don't ordinary people think about the price of their water at home, most businesses don't have to think about the price of water at all. Most farmers don't think about the price of water. They just use it. The 40% of people who don't have good access to water, that's amazing. Think about that for a minute. Wherever you work, whatever restaurant you're in, whatever school you go to, look to the left and the right. 4 out of 10 people in the world don't have good access to water, and yet we don't know anybody like that, although it's almost half the world. So about 15 to 20% of the world literally does not have access to clean, safe water. They drink muddy water and very small amounts, whatever they can get every day. And another 20% of the world has to walk every single day to get water. For that 40% of the world, water is actually probably the thing they think about most in their day. It shapes access to water, shapes their entire day. The 20% of the world that relies on walking to get water, they start the day walking to get water, and they end the day walking to get water. And if they're lucky, there are 3 or 4 hours in the middle of the day where they don't have to worry about fetching water. The availability of water literally determines whether people can go to school, what their access to, you know, economic opportunities and good jobs are. So I use the phrase water poverty and water wealth because I think lack of water doesn't just impoverish you in terms of the water, it actually impoverishes you in the larger sense because lack of access to water limits your other economic opportunities.
And what's happening now, as you point out, is that water access and access to clean water is changing as a result of all kinds of developments, including climate change and including the new pollutants that are the micropollutants that you talk about. Give us a little bit of a sketch of what happened, for example, in Spain and what happened in some of the places in the United States as well. Walk us through, starting with Spain.
Well, Spain was one of the European countries that was hit by a terrible drought, the area of Catalonia, and Barcelona, which is an enormous city of 5 million people, was running so short of water that they actually established an emergency pipeline project to bring water in from another region. They were building a water pipeline right down the middle of a superhighway. They used the right-of-way between the lanes going in opposite directions, and they were spending roughly $40 million to build that pipeline. And Barcelona was so concerned about water, they turned off the fountains. That's a city that is famous for its fountains. They turned off the beachside showers and started trying to, they contracted to bring in water by tanker, the same kind of tankers that move oil around the world, although these were obviously food-grade tankers. They hadn't been carrying petroleum any time recently. But it was a kind of silly gesture. It cost millions and millions of dollars, and twice a week a tanker would pull up to the docks in Barcelona. The docks had been modified to accommodate the ships, and those ships unloaded their entire cargoes of water, and it would provide 35 minutes of water for the city. And so what it really served to do was illustrate that you have to manage water problems in a much larger framework. If you get desperate and you're running a city of millions of people, tankers full of water will not rescue you. You have to have thought a little further ahead. In the United States, Atlanta also came close to running out of water. They rely on a nearby reservoir, and the reservoir dropped so that Atlanta really only had about 80 days of water. And again, Atlanta has doubled in size and doubled in size again since about 1970. And yet, the people responsible for managing Atlanta's growth and for making sure Atlanta has what it needs have never gone and tried to get secure new water supplies for the city. Atlanta actually sits in a pretty water-wealthy region in terms of natural rainfall and nearby lakes and so forth. But as the city began to run short of water, it was too late to go laying. You can't lay emergency pipelines for a city of 4 or 5 million people in 2 months. Things like that take planning, time, permitting. I hope that those kinds of examples, which I describe in some detail in the book, will sort of serve as a wake-up call. Atlanta is the perfect example of a place that has never thought about its water supply, and yet when a two-year-long drought settled in over the southeastern United States, all across Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, the water supplies dried up, and cities large and small found themselves in difficult positions. I think the point of telling those stories is to say both citizens and the people in charge of government and water supplies need to say, you know, it may be the case that the water situation we live with every day now might change. If the rainfall here fell 20 or 30% 3 years in a row, what would our water situation be then, and what can we do in advance? It's like having a fire extinguisher. You're never sorry you did some good water planning in advance. You know, you don't look at the fire extinguisher on your sink in the kitchen or on the wall at the office and say, well, that was a waste of money. If you need it, you're really glad it's there.
I thought it was quite funny that the way Georgia tried to handle their water crisis was by moving their border.
Well, it happens that Georgia and Atlanta sit just below the Tennessee River. And even in the midst of this drought, the Tennessee River is such a big river that there was more than enough water in it. But the Georgia border is below the Tennessee River. All they would need to do would have been to have had a border a mile further to the north. And so the Georgia legislature voted to move the border. Thank goodness states don't get to determine their own borders. And the Tennessee legislature was not interested in ceding any part of the Tennessee River to their neighbors to the south. There'd been no reason, of course. It's a funny example and silly, and it shows, you know, how absurd supposedly responsible people will be when it comes to solving water problems. But there had been no reason they couldn't have negotiated to get water from the Tennessee River in advance before the crisis, in case a crisis came along. Why wouldn't Tennessee have been willing to sell some of that water? It's just flowing down the river anyway, right? So it's both silly but also an example of how, if you think far enough in advance, most water problems turn out not to be water problems. They turn out to be people problems.
China's water crisis, it's really a global problem. You also talked about Australia at length, about all of the problems in Australia. And the weather patterns are changing.
Absolutely. So, yes, the story of China deciding that it's going to move enormous volumes of water from one part of the country to the other. The story described it as supplying water to Boston, New York, and Washington using canals from the Mississippi River. If you can imagine a canal that would cross all of Kentucky, Ohio, Massachusetts, New York, you know, another one arcing down toward Washington, D.C. Well, they're actually trying to do that in China with all kinds of implications. Now, that looks kind of astonishing and in some ways desperate to us. We, of course, did the same thing out west. I mean, that's how California, Arizona, and Las Vegas, Nevada are supplied with water with big diversion projects and big dam projects. We just did them 60 or 70 years ago, and so we've grown accustomed to them. I'm going to take issue with one thing you said. I think it's dangerous to say it's a global problem. The problems that are happening in North China, and the problems that happened in Atlanta, and the problems that happened in Barcelona, and the problems that happened in Australia aren't directly connected to each other. That is, we can say, oh boy, those folks down in Atlanta sure are in trouble, but I live in Philadelphia. Even if we have lots of water here, and we do, there's no way of helping the people in Atlanta. The people in Atlanta have to solve their own water problem. We can be sympathetic to the problems of China or sympathetic to the problems of Australia, but each region, even within those countries, has to tackle its own water problem. You know, the people in Orlando can't help the people in Atlanta, and if you all in California figure out how to solve your water problems, the good news is, the people in Minnesota can't undo it. They can't take some action that will undo your solution. So I think while lots of places in the world are having water problems at the same time, and the reasons for those water problems are related sort of thematically, climate change, economic development, growing population, it's important to remember that water problems are local, and the people who are having the problems have the ability in general to grab hold of them and figure out how to solve them. Polluted rivers in China means there's water, and there's somebody tainting the water, making it unusable, but there is water available. And so you could begin to fix the problem by not allowing people to destroy the water supply that you rely on, for instance. I think it's important to understand that while there may be this sort of outbreak of water problems in lots of different places around the world, it's not like the global economic crisis. You have to solve your own water problems, and most of the time, the tools to solve those problems are right at hand if we're willing to look at them clearly.
Well, let's talk about one of those examples. You noted that Las Vegas, which is the casino capital and has been using enormous amounts of water for its entertainment, and it's in the middle of a desert. You noted that they actually came up with some interesting creative solutions to keep this kind of crazy water display going. Talk about what happened.
Well, Las Vegas is a really interesting case. It's the driest city in America by far. Of the 280 largest cities in America, 280 gets you pretty far down the list. Las Vegas is far and away the driest. They get 4 inches of rain a year. It only rains about 20 days a year in Las Vegas. The temperature is over 100 for something like 75 days. So it's over 100 degrees in Las Vegas many more days a year than it actually rains. And Las Vegas relies on essentially a single source for all its water, Lake Mead, which is an enormous reservoir just outside the city. Lake Mead's actually 110 miles long, vast lake that is backed up by Hoover Dam. But Las Vegas can't take whatever it wants from Lake Mead. Las Vegas is limited by federal agreement to a very specific amount of water that hasn't changed in 50 years. So Las Vegas has, like Atlanta, Las Vegas has grown like mad. It, too, has doubled and doubled again in the last 30 years in terms of population, 3 or 4 times the number of people living there now as living there in 1970, but no new water available at all. And so Las Vegas really has had to reimagine how a city like that can manage its water use because it's only got one slug of water. They've imposed all kinds of fascinating rules to change the culture. It is illegal in Las Vegas to have a front lawn. All new houses, starting back in about 2000, are forbidden to have front lawns. And those same houses are only allowed grass on half of whatever the backyard is. The rest of the landscaping needs to be indigenous desert landscaping appropriate to Las Vegas. Well, 70% of the water that homeowners use in Las Vegas goes to watering the lawn. So if you begin to reduce the amount of lawn there is, then you begin to gradually, over time, reduce the amount of water they use. It's illegal to let your lawn sprinklers, if you're part of the grandfathered group or whatever lawn you have, it's illegal to let them hit the pavement or hit a road. They must hit only landscaped areas. And they actually have water cops who will fine you. They specify the kind of hose nozzle you can use to wash your car. It has to have an automatic shutoff. It only works when you're pressing on it. So they tell you what days you can water the lawn and what hours you can water, because watering in the middle of the day in the middle of the desert means you're wasting enormous quantities of water that simply evaporate, that never do any good for your lawn. The most important thing Las Vegas has done, though, is a kind of hidden measure, which is really important. Las Vegas collects every drop of water that is used indoors anywhere in the city, cleans it to a much higher level than is typical in most American cities, and returns it right to Lake Mead. Las Vegas recycles more than 90% of the water that hits a drain anywhere in the metro region. So they actually reuse their water over and over again. They clean it clean enough to put back in Lake Mead and get ready to be taken out again. And that's a number no American city can even come close to that Las Vegas hits. That also means you're not allowed to empty your swimming pool into a storm drain in Las Vegas. You're not allowed to empty your hot tub into a storm drain. You have to empty it right into the sanitary sewer. Because if you're going to dump 10,000 gallons worth of swimming pool water, they want it right back in the system, cleaned up, and returned to Lake Mead, not sprayed out across your lawn. The result is that they have really changed how people think about water and water use in Las Vegas. And over the last 20 years, they've reduced the per-person use of water by 30%. And so they've been able to grow the city without having to add water sources by changing how people use their water and even how they think about it. You know, no one would imagine letting their sprinkler spray on a hot road, which is something that happens all the time across America.
Let's talk for a minute about bottled water.
Okay.
And as you pointed out, a lot of times, you know, our infrastructure starts to fall apart. People don't want to pay for the infrastructure. They say, we'll buy bottled water. That doesn't work for multiple reasons. Give us the cost, the collective cost of bottled water on our system, and also give us the truth about bottled water.
Well, it's interesting. I got started on the path to writing The Big Thirst with a story about bottled water. I spent several months trying to understand the bottled water business. I grew up in the 1960s and 1970s when there was no bottled water at all. We used water fountains. We drank out of the tap at home. There literally was no bottled water business. And I was puzzled as a journalist where the business had come from. After all, we're buying something in stores that is literally free in our homes. And there are lots of things we're very touchy about the price of, so why would we be spending money for something we get free? You asked about the cost, and I think this is one of the more striking things, another way that we sort of don't connect the dots in the water world. In the United States, we spend $21 billion a year on bottled water as consumers every year, $21 billion a year. We spend $29 billion a year maintaining the entire water infrastructure of the country, all the treatment plants, the pumps, the pipes, modernization, maintenance, the whole thing. So we spend almost as much on crushable plastic bottles filled with water as we do on the entire critical infrastructure for the country. So when people say to me there's no money in the system for fixing the water system, I just laugh and say, no, actually there is. In fact, we're already spending that money on water. It's just coming one little plastic bottle at a time. I actually don't think it's my job or anybody's job to tell you whether to drink bottled water or not. I think if people understand it, they'll be a little less inclined to drink it. It's not my job to tell you whether you should be drinking Fiji water or San Pellegrino or Evian, but those products do leave an incredible trail behind them. Only about 25% of the plastic bottles get recycled. So 75% of the plastic bottles in which bottled water is delivered end up in the landfill, which is just ridiculous. You think about that plastic bottle as a kind of a permanent container. It will never go away. 100 years ago, it would have been considered a miracle to have a bottle that was that light and that strong that you could use over and over again. We literally take four swallows of water, and then we throw the 1,000-year container in the garbage. Anybody who's drinking bottled water should at least take the trouble to make sure the container gets recycled. And the truth is, some people drink bottled water because they like the taste. Some people think it's safer. It is certainly no safer than tap water. In fact, it is not as closely regulated as tap water. So there are people who say they can tell the difference. In blind taste tests with water exactly the same temperature, almost no one, including the bottled water people, can ever tell the difference. And the truth is, you drink tap water, it's a little warm out of the tap. You drink bottled water, it's ice cold out of the refrigerator case in the store or out of your own refrigerator. Plus, it comes in the bottle, so you sort of have a psychological association. But it is absolutely no safer. And part of the impact is what we started out talking about, which is bottled water will not save you. Atlanta could not have relied on bottled water if Lake Lanier, its reservoir, ran desperately low. There's not enough bottled water in the country to keep even one city going on a regular basis. I think bottled water has a tendency to undermine confidence in tap water, and the truth is that the municipal water system of the country is vital to the economic vibrancy of the country. We need to not confuse bottled water with municipal water systems.
Let's talk for a moment about the Safe Drinking Water Act. You noted that it has 91 contaminants that it regulates, but there are a whole host of new ones, micropollutants, drugs. What is the reality of the pollutants in our water and in contrast with the Safe Drinking Water Act?
Well, the Safe Drinking Water Act has been updated a couple times in the last 30 years, but it's clearly out of date compared to what the threats to the water supply are. And anybody who's listening can sort of just think about themselves and the people they know. I don't think my parents took any medicines routinely when they were the age that I am. You know, we not only take Motrin and acetaminophen when our backs bother us in middle age, plenty of people are on maintenance high blood pressure drugs, maintenance cholesterol drugs, maintenance birth control pills that didn't even exist 50 years ago, maintenance antidepressants. So all of that stuff is great in medical terms, but a little bit of it leaks out of our bodies every time we pee, and it ends up in the toilet, and it ends up in the water supply. And the current treatment plant, the wastewater treatment plants that the water goes to from your home, and the water treatment plants that are responsible for cleaning fresh water and delivering it to us at the front end, none of those are set up to take out this class of kind of pharmaceutical, what I call micropollutant. These products appear in absolutely minuscule quantities. An average person might earn $10 million in the course of an entire life of earnings, and these micropollutants appear in the equivalent of less than one penny out of $10 million, a lifetime's earnings. So very, very small quantities. And yet, we keep adding, and these drugs are specifically designed to have an impact at minuscule levels. Your question was, what's the truth about those pollutants? And unfortunately, the truth is we don't know. We don't know what impact they have on human beings. They clearly have an impact on fish and other marine and amphibious life when those pollutants begin to accumulate in lakes and rivers and bodies of water. Now, of course, the fish and the amphibians are living in the water. They're not drinking, you know, a liter a day. They're actually swimming through it and breathing it all the time. So they're much more likely to be sensitive and much more likely to be affected by small quantities. Those things can, in fact, be taken out of the water. It's not actually a technical challenge at all. It's simply a financial challenge. Only about 10% of the water that each of us uses each day is used for potable purposes. Most of it, 90% of it, goes for things that don't require purified water. If you were to take all those micropollutants out of every gallon of municipal water in the country, you'd double the water bill. Now, of course, the water bill is only $35 a month on average, $34 a month on average for an American home. So even doubling the water bill would barely bring it up to what our cell phones cost. But Americans wouldn't tolerate that. We need a new sort of focus of research on what those micropollutants do both to us and to the environment where they sit after we, you know, use those products and the wastewater is discharged into a river or a lake or wherever. And we probably need a little bit of a technical leap to take those micropollutants back out. And the place to take them out isn't before we drink the water, but at the point at which wastewater is treated, so that we don't actually taint the environment where the water is deposited with these man-made pharmaceuticals, the impact of which we're just trying to understand. We're ready for a kind of new, a second revolution in water cleanliness, and I hope that gets enough attention. That is something people pay attention to. They don't want Prozac in their drinking water, even in very small quantities.
Well, Charles Fishman, the book is called The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, how memory entrepreneurs are working to change how you remember the past as a means to shape the future. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Can reconfiguring our memories of the past affect the future? Has memory itself become a political battleground? Some political scientists have found that so-called memory entrepreneurs try to reshape our memories as a means to advance particular policy agendas. One of these battles has been the effort to shape our memories of the Cold War, to have it remembered as a good fight, like World War II, in which good triumphed over evil. How has this battle been waged? And has it been successful? John Wiener joins us now. He's a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine. He's the author of numerous books, including Gimme Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files, and his latest, How We Forgot the Cold War, A Historical Journey Across America. Ellen Schrecker is also with us. She is a professor of history at Yeshiva University and the author of several books, including Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and The Age of McCarthyism, A Brief History with Documents. Doug Becker is also with us. He is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. Among his publications are The Bush Administration's Campaign Against the International Criminal Court and also The Use of Memory and Trauma in Foreign Policymaking, which has been Memory and Trauma in International Relations. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar's Circle. It's great to have you. Doug Becker, I want to start with you. You put this idea of official memory and shaping historical memory into a political context, almost like a political tool, and it's changed over the years. How would you say it has been changing, and what have been the effects?
Thank you for having me. History is certainly not static by any stretch of the imagination. Our understandings are the lessons that we draw from history, even certainly questions about causations within history will change. And although any good historian will certainly tell you they'll change because evidence is changing and because our knowledge of patterns from the past have changed, also there are social and political causes for those change. Specifically, history is used by contemporary political actors. It's certainly a component for contemporary political actors about shaping identity, about learning lessons from the past, about trying to blunt criticism for current policies, trying to draw a linkage between your current policy preferences and something that happened in the past. Some of this is natural. I mean, the idea that contexts of history, the lessons of history, the meanings within history will change generationally, will change over the years, is a natural, organic process. But it's not always simply natural and organic. And there are certainly individuals with vested political interests in either maintaining old historical narratives are creating new historical narratives, adjusting the contemporary narratives. The term that we use for those are memory entrepreneurs. And one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is, first, why would a memory entrepreneur try to alter our understandings within history, try to create a new narrative? But also, I want to caution us that an attempt to alter history by a memory entrepreneur doesn't alter it. What it does is it creates an arena of political contestation. And sometimes it becomes dialectical, left versus right, and you know, something that Hegel would certainly be proud of. But in some cases, it can be very multifaceted. And the ways in which political actors will take these attempts at altering history, either to directly confront it, reject it, or manipulate it for their own benefits. So the lessons here is, if history's changing, asks whose interest is it to change? Who's trying to change it? And then how can contemporary political actors go with these changes to serve their current political preferences?
Ellen Schrecker, would you agree with this?
I think so, though I think the way Doug is presenting this is as if there are sort of individuals out there with some kind of agenda. And I think it's much more a question of what can history be used for. I'm just teaching a course now. We're just getting up to Vietnam. I teach contemporary American history. And this is the moment at which American policymakers, in order to justify a military escalation in Vietnam, begin to talk about Munich. That's the lesson that they want to bring from history to show that we've got to stand up to whatever it is we have to stand up to. So you can do almost anything with history to justify a current practice. But in the hands of policymakers, you see often a distortion and a focus on certain lessons and a totally ignoring other lessons or other moments.
Well, that's actually the perfect place to bring in John Wiener, who's just written this book, How We Forgot the Cold War, A Historical Journey Across America, which speaks to this exactly.
I love Doug's concept of memory entrepreneurs. And one of the things I was interested in my book, How We Forgot the Cold War, was the efforts of, in particular, mainstream conservative memory entrepreneurs to shape the public understanding of the Cold War. The idea they presented is a very coherent one, a very comprehensive one. The Cold War, you may have heard this before, was a battle between freedom and slavery, between good and evil. The United States triumphed because one man in particular, Ronald Reagan, remained true to his values and refused to compromise with evil, unlike certain other people we could mention. Richard Nixon, for example, with the detente. Reagan went to the Brandenburg Gate. Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And they did. Good triumphed over evil, the end. In my book, I set out on a trip across the United States to visit monuments and museums and memorials about the Cold War to see how this message was going over with the public. And what I found was that the public wasn't really remembering the Cold War at all. The public was forgetting about the Cold War, that the efforts of the, let's call them Reaganite memory entrepreneurs in this case, don't seem to have succeeded. I found somewhere between, I don't know, skepticism, apathy, and maybe some resistance to this notion.
You spoke specifically, or you wrote, I should say, specifically about this legacy resource management program. What was the scope of this?
That sounds kind of bureaucratic, doesn't it?
I mean, was it just these memorials or was there more to it?
This was like the very day that the Soviet Union collapsed. Congress was aware and passed legislation in the Defense Appropriation Act, we're in 1991 now, to create the public memory of the Cold War. And this was not just through museums, monuments, memorials, but through archival records and all kinds of things that we want them to do. Clearly, they were aware of the political value of creating a certain definition of the Cold War. And I want to emphasize, I've been calling this the Reaganite definition, but really it was completely bipartisan. I'm sure when Ellen Schrecker teaches this course, she teaches the Democrats were just as much a part of this idea that we need to have a nuclear deterrent to defend freedom and that the military budgets are an unfortunate necessity. And starting with Harry Truman in 1947, right through Bill Clinton, we find bipartisan consensus about the importance of conveying to the public this way of understanding the Cold War and what it means.
Ellen Schrecker?
It's a very highly militarized notion of the Cold War, which I think is a lot of what John was finding, that so many of these places that he was visiting were on military bases, had something to do with this militarization of American foreign policy that the Cold War brought about. And that's something that obviously falls away when we talk about the Cold War, because it's often presented, I know I see this with my own students, as a kind of morality play. And a lot of what is popular history out there does come through in a very oversimplified, you know, good guys versus bad guys kind of way that drives historians up the wall. This is not the way we like to think about history.
Doug Becker, you have done quite a bit of research on Reagan and the development of his legacy. You had a name for it, too. I think it was called something like the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project. How does this comport with what you found?
No, it actually fits it rather well. There's one point I want to make about this question of the morality play. One of the great ironies is certainly within international relations, the traditional school of realism, and who's always credited with being the father of containment, George Kennan, always complained about the moral components of containment and the way the morality play plays itself out, which raises an interesting question when we create a history that the reason why the U.S. won the Cold War was because of containment, because of hard-headed you know, hard-reasoned rationalist policies, when in reality, both the historians and the policymakers themselves seem to be rather emotional in that response. But to your question about the Reagan Legacy Project, yeah, I mean, the idea that you would finger an individual, at one level, certainly individuals have a key role to play, but it's rare that a single individual could have a significant impact. But in the case of the Reagan Legacy Project, there actually was. It was the brainchild, at least in its contemporary form, of Grover Norquist, who we all know quite well. And it was in 1997, and the direct political interest in his project was a collective coming to grips with the fact that they just lost a second presidential election to Bill Clinton and wanted to emphasize that Ronald Reagan was the direct opposite of Clinton, that he was moral. You know, he stuck to his guns. He was the sort of leader that stood by moral guideposts. And at one level, what Norquist wanted to do was name one thing after Ronald Reagan in every county in America. And that's why you start seeing all these things named. So when you examine the contemporary political motivations for this, the use of Munich as a justification to intervene in any sort of conflict because every individual that might threaten the peace is the new Hitler, and also the militarized response, I'm always struck by the use of, you know, a term that gets used in the neoconservative community is a neo-Reaganite foreign policy. And they used it to justify military intervention in Iraq, despite the fact, I mean, the historical record is quite clear. The only time Ronald Reagan ever used the military was to invade tiny Grenada. And most historians and political scientists alike believe that that had much more to do with domestic politics and the collective concern about what would happen as a result of the bombing in Beirut, as opposed to freeing this tiny nation of its communist overlord. So,
John Wiener.
I'm very interested in this whole issue of the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project and where it stands today. If you go out to Simi Valley, where the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum is, this is the white hot heart of Reagan memory in the world. This is the place, above all others, where we should hear about Reagan's lifelong commitment to fighting evil. What we find is that the Reagan Library has kind of lost confidence that people will come out there to hear about Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall. They think what people want to hear about is Walt Disney. And indeed, their attendance doubled after they opened the Walt Disney exhibit. They do have exhibits about Reagan and the Cold War and the Berlin Wall, and there's a little corner about Grenada if you want to read the fine print. But what is big is an exhibit on the history of Walt Disney, the largest temporary exhibit they've ever had at the Reagan Library. Why? What does this have to do with Ronald Reagan? The answer is virtually nothing. The show is organized not by the National Archives, which operates the Reagan Library, and the mission of the National Archives is to preserve the records and history of the people of the United States of America. This exhibit was organized by the Walt Disney Fan Club. This is a sign that the memory entrepreneurs are not succeeding at their mission and they're having to look elsewhere.
Well, we keep mentioning tear down this wall and crediting Ronald Reagan with this. Ellen Schrecker, perhaps you can set the record straight for us. What did happen? Did Ronald Reagan tear down this wall?
I'm afraid not. But what did happen was that the Soviet Union crumbled from within because of a whole bunch of reasons. It was unsustainable. Technology was back. I mean, you know, all kinds of internal reasons. It was a very rigid system that promoted all kinds of cheating. And what the triumphalist, you know, your true believers in Reagan as the architect of the end of the evil empire, is based on the notion that when Ronald Reagan decides to adopt the technology of Star Wars, which most people probably don't remember, it was something called the Strategic Defense Initiative, and the idea was to create a huge shield of missiles that would shoot down Soviet missiles whenever they came over. Reagan pumps a lot of money in it, essentially daring the Soviets to match him in military spending on this very fancy technology that doesn't seem to work. The idea was that Reagan had kind of spent the Soviet Union into bankruptcy, and that's why the wall came down. it's a much more complicated issue than that and owes a lot more to the inherent problems of the Soviet system than it does to a rather late attempt on the part of Ronald Reagan to, quote-unquote, spend the evil empire into destruction. But this has become the kind of mantra of Cold War triumphalists that Reagan, by creating this very strange defense system that doesn't work, defeated the Soviet Union.
Doug Becker?
I find it very interesting that the Reagan Library has this concern about trying to get folks to come out there. And the people who I know who've gone out to the library typically go because they want to see the replica of Air Force One that's there. But what I find that's quite striking is the Reagan Triumphal School is certainly a component of political ideology in the United States. Whether the Soviet Union crumbled or Reagan caused it to crumble, how you would answer that question is, I would suspect, is very strongly correlated to general political preferences, whether you're conservative or liberal, Democrat or Republican. But the thing that I find quite striking is that the lesson of the Triumphal School, that words matter, that ideas matter, and that a speech can change world events, replays itself in the Arab Spring. As Arab governments are certainly being toppled, you in essence have both the left and right arguing that their leader, whether it was George Bush's freedom agenda or Barack Obama's speech at Cairo, is the one that's most responsible for that. So both parties are wrapping themselves up in that lesson. But the real concern I had for this was not the question of whether Reagan was a great president or not, but if Reagan was a great president because he ushered in the end of the Cold War, I think most historians and political scientists alike would agree that Reagan's greatness lie not with delivering a speech and refusing to negotiate with evil, but because Reagan recognized that the Soviet Union had changed, that Gorbachev was a different type of leader, someone that the U.S. could do business with. And although that isn't what caused the collapse of the Soviet Union, it certainly advanced American interest with things like the Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Treaty and the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaties, etc. And the linkages that Gorbachev had with the West certainly constrained the Soviets' policy options once the wall starts to crumble. So if it was deft diplomacy on the part of Reagan and then Bush, how interesting, by the way, Bush has never given credit for the end of the Cold War.
Although he does have a piece of the wall, I understand.
Yeah, apparently. But what's interesting is if there's a lesson to be learned, it's exactly the opposite lesson of things like the Axis of Evil speech, where you declare Iran evil and then say, we're going to stand up and then Iran's going to get rid of their nuclear program, as opposed to negotiating with Iran. Dare I say, if Reagan were president today, he would be considerably more open to the notion of negotiation with Iran than certainly his conservative descendants would suggest that he would be.
Who often use his name as their representative. So this Reagan idea and the memorial is one of, what, two dozen that John Wiener actually went to and looked at to try to get a sense about this memory that was being shaped, this official memory in how we forgot the Cold War. I was struck by what was included, but also what was left out. We talked about a couple of these before we started the tape. What did you find most remarkable about what was left out and who was left out?
Let me just stick with this Berlin Wall thing for a minute. The Berlin Wall is the great icon of the end of the Cold War and of America's victory in the Cold War and of Reagan going to the Brandenburg Gate and giving his speech. There's something like 40 different places in the United States that display segments of the Berlin Wall. Here, we're in Southern California. There's at least half a dozen spots in Los Angeles or in the LA area that have Berlin Wall exhibits. And indeed, it is a powerful object. And indeed, it did separate a totalitarian state from capitalist democratic state. But when I visited some of these sites around the country, it's just remarkable how many ways the significance of the Berlin Wall is explained and how few of them mention Ronald Reagan. For example, Ellen Schrecker right now speaking to us from Manhattan on East 53rd Street, there's a Westpocket Park that displays a piece of the Berlin Wall. And what the historical marker there says is that this wall marked the border between East and West Germany from 1962 to 1989. period. A border, like the border, I guess, between Canada and the United States. Not the border between slavery and freedom. Not the border between good and evil. That's all they have to say about it. They don't mention Ronald Reagan. There's another segment of it at the Microsoft campus outside of Seattle. Microsoft has a big art collection. They have a piece of the Berlin Wall that they exhibit, and they say they're exhibiting it because it's a work of graffiti art. And indeed, there is graffiti all over most of the Berlin Wall segments. And again, they don't mention Ronald Reagan at all, or slavery or freedom. The most remarkable one I found is in Las Vegas at one of the more downscale casinos, the Main Street Station Casino, which is in the, let's call it the budget area of Las Vegas, downtown. They have an exhibit called Pee on the Berlin Wall. And their segment is in the men's room behind the urinals. And they say, gentlemen, pee on the Berlin Wall. It's one of the reasons to go to this casino. So what's left out? Ronald Reagan.
So you've gone to what, to 24?
Something like that.
So about 24 memorials that were dedicated to the Cold War. And if you were going to make a composite of them, and you were going to draw a picture, you as a person who was trying to understand the Cold War by these, what are the big missing pieces and what are the big emphases?
What I found was there's basically three different varieties of these. There's the sort of the true believer exhibits that hold to the, we could call it the Reaganite narrative here. And those are pretty much empty and forlorn and nobody goes there. Nobody wants to hear about it. Then there are the ones that they're sort of entrepreneurial zeal where they change their focus to some other part of history. For instance, there's a Winston Churchill memorial in the middle of Missouri where Churchill gave that famous speech from Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, and Iron Curtain has descended across the continent. They built a museum at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, place where he gave that speech, but nobody came. But they changed that museum. Now it is a museum of I have nothing to offer but blood, sweat, and tears. It's about the Battle of Britain. It's about the Royal Air Force. It's about their finest hour. That's the story that people would rather hear about Winston Churchill. They don't really want to hear about the Iron Curtain. And then there's still other places where the Cold War is just a pretext for something completely different. If you drive down the 5 freeway in California to San Diego, there's a huge cross on a hilltop, a 40-foot-high cross. The ACLU has been litigating for decades to have this removed. It's on public property, and it's a violation of the separation of church and state. The people who built the cross say it's a Korean War memorial. Now, really, it doesn't have anything to do with the Korean War. Really, it is a religious object. But they are using the Cold War as a pretext to defend something which otherwise would get them in trouble.
What I'm gathering from you is this a very disparate story that is being told, and it's not being told very well, and it's not really very convincing. Ellen Schrecker, what do you make of this?
There's some pieces of history that people seem attracted to, and it really follows current political events. For example, I took my granddaughters to go see the movie about Lincoln. Now, why is a movie about Lincoln coming out now? Obviously, it's pushing 200 years. But I think this movie at this time is also telling us something about race relations in the United States at a moment when we have, for the first time, an African-American president. So I just wonder about a question of timing. What historical moments get dealt with at what times? And it seems to me that popular culture often picks up things that even though sort of what you call triumphalist entrepreneurs or whatever may be pushing, it's not going to get picked up, that there's something else going on, that there's a contemporary story. And if it can get grafted onto some historical moment, then it probably will be.
John Weider's conclusion was ultimately that this effort has more or less failed, which is clear by How We Forgot the Cold War, the title. But there are some other efforts that seem wildly successful, and we've been speaking about Ronald Reagan. That seems to be one of them. And Doug Becker, you have written about this, how many people invoke Ronald Reagan when they give a speech, how many freeways they try to name after him, and even a mountain. Why do we have such a failure on memory entrepreneurship on the Cold War versus somebody like Ronald Reagan?
There's a couple things going on. First of all, what you're finding with respect to Reagan's role at ending the Cold War and the Cold War itself is this arena of political contestation. There's been a pushback, and at least at one level, I think it's fair to say that the Reagan Triumphal School, that they overplayed their hand by making the argument so blatant and also, quite frankly, so partisan that that's part of the reason for the pushback. Another part, though, I think, is that people aren't terribly interested in the details of the history of the Cold War, yet they've drawn conclusions on how the Cold War has ended and those processes without any sort of background. You ask somebody about the invasion of Grenada, and they'll answer it was to free the country from communists. You ask somebody about the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was to free the country from communists. Very, very simple sort of explanation so that superficially this memory continues. But it's not terribly detailed, it's not terribly deep, it's not terribly nuanced, and it certainly would never meet the standard that any historian would hold it to in terms of being a narrative per se. It's not as much a narrative as, quite frankly, more like a cartoon. It still gets invoked, and it's still this arena of intense contestation, but it is interesting that it's fading, and maybe the lesson here is that memorials aren't terribly successful any longer at the creation of memory.
Well, there are plenty more vignettes that we didn't get to in How We Forgot the Cold War, and some very important ones, I thought, John Wiener, including the, as we talked about, the CIA memorial and the Second Security Memorial, very
National
important.
National Security Agency in Maryland has
and
a
the,
museum.
And the memorial to the so-called victims of the Cold War. But we're just going to have to cover that another time. I'd like to thank our three scholars, Ellen Schrecker, John Wiener, and Doug Becker. Thank you all so much. John Wiener is a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine. He's the author of numerous books, including Gimme Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files, and How We Forgot the Cold War, A Historical Journey Across America. Ellen Schrecker is a professor of history at Yeshiva University and the author of several books, including Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and The Age of McCarthyism, A Brief History with Documents. Doug Becker is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. Among his publications are The Bush Administration's Campaign Against the International Criminal Court and also The Use of Memory and Trauma in Foreign Policymaking, which has been Memory and Trauma in International Relations. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @armudian.